I don't know. I can't remember any dates or whatever, but I can remember that weird header password. I can remember the password of my first domain admin that I popped, you know, like, but I can't remember.
I don't remember my own mom's birthday, exactly. But I remember this header.
Exactly.
Hey, what's up, guys? Before we get into the show, I wanted to mention something super quick from our friends at ThreatLocker. And I actually think you all are going to think it's pretty awesome because so much of bug bounty is often, you know, kind of quoted as like, yeah, but hackers will never exploit that because they can just get in via phishing. Well, that's actually true. You know, most of the time, whenever companies get breached, it's because of phishing or access to that user's account, or, you know, they do something like do a whole bunch of push notification 2FA and eventually a user gets so much fatigue, they approve it. But they have a solution for this. ThreatLocker has a thing called Zero Trust Cloud Access, right? Which prevents access to cloud resources or SaaS resources based on the device you're logging in from. So if a user gets phished, right? They put in their credentials, like they get phished or they get vished. The attacker has their credentials. Maybe they even have a way to get the MFA because they did some sort of SIM swap because they have a hookup at Verizon or AT&T or whatever, right? So they have the credentials, they have the MFA, they still can't get in because the Zero Trust Cloud Access like will basically straight up allow or deny people access to resources based on the device you're logging in from. So if you're an enterprise or a company and you're concerned about the highest risk, which really is phishing, this is a way to add another like basically impenetrable layer to preventing it and securing your network. Back to the show.
All right, dude. I guess we'll cut right in. I don't know, man. If you want to release the episode, we'll release the episode. But this is some crazy shit you're about to talk about. So, Brute, thanks for coming on, man. I really appreciate it. Obviously, you've done a lot of... to be honest, that one blog post that you put with the rec to proto was like an life-changing thing for me when hacking Google. So you have nothing to prove, but the tradition is the tradition. So let's go ahead and start off with a bug before we get into your introduction.
So thanks so much for having me in the pod. Mm-hmm. So yeah, the first bug I'll cover here is remote code execution in Borg Grant's Google Cloud production. So this bug is actually super interesting. Like it's my first RC. Well, it's two RCs, but the way I found it was, so I had this whole AI scanning like set up, right? So my AI scanner would scan like all the APIs in entire Google, and it would let me know if like any of them have a potential bug, right? So this scanner actually notified me about a few endpoints in this API. So Cloud CRM IP frontend PA.google APIs. It's a mouthful, but yeah, it was super interesting because the first endpoint I found was like this endpoint. It took in like a Gaia ID and it would return an email. So this kind of like reminded me of like my old research or whatever. So this by itself was kind of cool, but I looked through the other endpoints in this API, right? And I saw some really weird endpoint. There was like this endpoint where it was like called get proto definition. Mm. So in Google, right, everything is proto buff, right? Literally everything. So even the request that you send, it's just proto buff. It's just a proto buff message, right? So if you can leak the type of this proto buff message, you can then use this get proto definition endpoint, and it would just dump the whole proto buff there. So, dude. So that was super useful.
That is like
okay, I wanted the screen gadget. but yeah. I asked Sam, and they're like, nope, you're not allowed. So I got stuck there. But yeah. I would have loved to archive this for the whole Google.
Yeah. Oh my gosh, dude. I have chills just thinking about that. Like now every because like to be honest, man, one of the hardest things about hacking on Google is literally just dealing with the proto JSON, proto buff nonsense that they kick out all the time. There's so much obscurity in there that you know, it's horrible. So man, having the keys to the kingdom like that must have felt great.
Exactly. And I think that mostly Google is people think it's a hard target, but I think it's just security by obscurity for a lot of it. Because how do you know which endpoints to hit or whatever? It's not like a traditional target in the sense that most other like apps or whatever. Mm-hmm. In this target, it's super weird. You have to just recon is like probably the most important thing in Google, right? So that's why I published the Recto Proto research, which is essentially this tool where you can hit any endpoint and uses like JSON plus protobuf. It's like this GSPB. It's like a super weird content type, but for some reason, Google's backend will like leak a bunch of error messages, so you can like probe it with like random payloads, and it will start dumping like everything it wants protobuf. Mm. So you can use this and like build out the whole request protobuf with this, right? So this is super useful for a lot of my research. But the only problem is that it only works for APIs that have this specific content type enabled, right?
Right.
Which a lot of APIs don't. So this would have allowed for like dumping the protobufs for those, and or even batch execute, or these kind of like weird APIs. They're all protobuf, but how are you supposed to know like what each parameter is? It's just super confusing. But yeah, with this you could have done that. So I mean, I did use it a fair bit for here and there for like some of the research I'm working on to kind of like see what each of them are. But I couldn't touch too much on it. Yeah, but anyways, I looked more into this API, right? Because it was super interesting, and I saw that there was like this weird endpoint. It's called like list quota queue. So it was taking it like a filter parameter. So in Google, right, the most annoying error that I keep getting is like invalid argument. So for hacking like server side, you just use, it's like super generic error. It doesn't tell you anything. If you hit the same error in like intranet inside Google, right, it'll actually dump the full stack trace, but they don't give that to us. So we're kind of screwed. Mm.
That's interesting.
I was looking at like the parameters that I could supply in this API, and one of them was like a filter parameter, right? And filter usually means like it usually follows some sort of like AIP standard, right? So I looked up the standard of this filter, and I was trying a bunch of stuff. Like I tried like various different things, and eventually I tried like client ID is greater than like 123 or something, and that just worked.
My gosh. So this is like a filtered language that you're getting in here that you can inject. Okay.
Yeah, it's like some sort of, I'm not too sure how it looks like in the back end, but I assume it's just some implementation of this AIP, right? Mm. So because everything in the AIP seemed to work here.
AIP
so,
ones.
Yeah, I tried this, but
this. Yeah, okay. Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah. So yeah, I tried that, but the problem was it would say some error like, we can't convert the response to JSON. Because I'm guessing they didn't set up like a JSON like a conversion thing for this. I didn't have like a protobuf or something for this. So yeah, that was a problem. So I didn't know how to get past that at first. Then I kind of realized that, yeah, I can just use like alt equals to proto, right? But even that had its problems because you can't just supply protobuf in like a JSON or like a, okay, so this endpoint is just client6.google.com, right? And client6.google.com is like an alias to Google APIs .com. But the difference is you can use cookies with it, mm-hmm. right? That's what's kind of useful about it. Mm. But the problem is you can't use protobuf like direct, you can't protobuf responses directly into client6.google.com because Google like freaks out about it. Like I'm not too sure why. I'm assuming some sort of like XSS prevention. I don't know. But they don't allow you to.
There's some like when you say protobuf responses, you mean like binary protobuf, not the proto-JSON.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
So yeah, they just freak out. But so I remember this one trick, right? So I'm sure, do you guys know who Ezequiel Pereira is?
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Yes.
Okay. So I love this guy's content. So he had like some random video uploaded, like I think one of his talks in Bugswat, right? Mm-hmm. So I literally went through every single second of that whole talk and like took down notes and everything. Everything he says is a gospel.
Yeah.
So I was taking notes like constantly. And one of those notes in one of the second of his like hour long video was this header. Xgook encode response if executable base64.
Wow, dude. Okay. So now you've got this header that allows you to mutate the protobuf that's coming out of the backend.
Yeah, exactly. So it converts it to base64, which is allowed for the front end or whatever. So it's allowed for client6 on google.com. So once I had this, I could then dump like the response in base64. It was massive, by the way. It was like super big. I think like the server took like 10 seconds to even respond back. And then I just use like the protoc command line tool, and I just like dumped everything. Mm. I mean, I was able to also use the same, remember the get proto definition? I could just use that to just kind of find the proto definition for this, and I was able to decode it back.
Wow.
Did you get to this stop like point where you needed that header, and then you went and did the research to find it, or did you already have that research like saved off, and then you just like when you were kind of scrambling, then you found it?
I mean, it just came to me because I remembered okay, everything because okay, I took down all the notes, right? Mm.
Yeah, basically yeah, you had it up in the noggin. No AI there. Just he had it.
That's the classic like, you know, hyper-focus hacker mentality is like I don't know, I can't remember any dates or whatever, but I can remember that weird header or that password. I can remember the password of my first domain admin that I popped, you know, like, but I can't remember.
I don't remember my own mom's birthday, exactly. But I remember this.
Exactly. Header. Exactly, dude. It's that hyper hacker focus. That's a great tip though. When converting, if you're getting raw protobuf out of a, you know, client6.google, right, then, or I guess you won't be, but you can get this out with this, which is pretty cool. And so let me ask one clarifying question here, though, because you said Google APIs, right? That's, of course, Google APIs and client6.google.com have a, you know, relationship there. If were you saying that googleapis.com, you can get the raw proto out, but you can't do it on client6?
But you can't use first-party, you can't use first-party authentication. This whole endpoint was working with first-party auth, which is a cookie auth, right? Mm. So you can't use it with Google APIs. That's a problem.
Mm. Okay. So if you tried to hit the same endpoint on Google APIs, it wouldn't work because first-party auth doesn't work there. So you had to do it through client 6.
Mm. Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wow. Very interesting, man. You know a lot of these little quirks of Google. This is, once again, I can't believe you're sharing this, but thank you so much. This is very helpful. So, all right, well, you finally get the response out, Base64, you proto-C to get the actual raw data out, and what do you see?
So inside there, it was a bunch of like random stuff, like random like workflow, internal workflows. So I was looking at what exactly it is. It seemed to be some sort of like task. So a Googler can configure a task, right? Mm. And then this is the execution log of the task, right? So I was seeing some weird like spanner syncing to Salesforce. So spanner is like Google's like internal database. I mean, they have the cloud product for it as well, but right. They use this everywhere. So it was already quite interesting. So okay, at this point, I already like reported it because like I don't want to touch too much. Like I've had experience in the past where like I went too far or whatever. So I don't want to risk anything. So I just reported. Then I keep looking after that, right? So I sent the report, but then I wanted to see like even deeper. Because see, they're executing tasks here. So can I execute my own task? Because mm-hmm. that would be pretty interesting. So I looked through the discovery document, right? So I was scanning through the whole document and I noticed like one thing was super interesting. Generic stubby type task v2. Mm. So this instantly set off like red flags for me. Because so if you know anything about Google, right? So stubby is their internal RPC format. So okay, just a like a refresher or whatever. If you send any request to a Google API, right, it's actually just sending to some sort of RPC. So some of these RPCs are like exposed or some of them are internal, right? So let's say I send a request to like compute.googleapis.com or whatever. So that server that's handling that board task or whatever, it can also fetch like other RPCs to fetch whatever it needs and then it returns it back to you, right? So it does this through stubby using a production account. So something like whatever prod.google.com, right? So if you can somehow like execute arbitrary stubby queries, you can reach all these like internal RPCs that would otherwise not be exposed publicly. Wow. Right. So it's a massive restriction.
So it's kind of like an SSRF at Google, because I know they famously told me like, oh, we don't really have SSRF, but being able to make arbitrary stubby RPC calls is basically the equivalent of an SSRF at Google, right?
Yeah, exactly. And in fact, I would say like an RCE in Google, most people like think of RCE as like, oh, I have shell access to the server, right? But in Google, it doesn't really work that way. Like even if you have remote code execution on a board task, which is like, If you manage to like any sort of Google application, if you get code execution, it's on a board task. But what is the real impact there? Sure, you can see what's being processed locally, but that's still like a sandbox environment. The real impact here is the stubby access, which is why they pay so much for stubby, right?
Mm, okay, guys. So we really need to take away from this here that anytime you see stubby, you need to be very interested, which is very interesting because I actually, one of my bugs that I've had, I submitted recently to Google, it utilized a stubby endpoint. And I was like, I don't know why this works, but it works. And so anyway, we'll have to compare notes on that afterwards because I haven't gotten any disclosure permission on that. Maybe you can do something with that I couldn't. But that is really interesting, man. So just to clarify, you know, traditional architecture for RCE is, you know, you get a shell, you take over the server, whatever. Google, you know, infrastructure architecture is a little different. All of these APIs are being mapped back to a central RPC sort of environment. And, you know, typically it's taking an API endpoint and mapping that to an RPC call. But there might be some scenarios where you can take a API call and map it to an arbitrary RPC call, right? And that is where you get RC, really impactful RCE on Google. Is my understanding that correctly?
Yeah, if they have some weird proxy thing, which just like proxies stubby queries exactly like this kind of sounds like it would do. Wow. Generic stubby type task. Sounds like I can just send anything I want. Freaking right. Beautiful. So it was pretty interesting. Yeah, so I was looking forward to this and I was trying to see, okay, is there a way I can like configure this task or whatever, mm-hmm. right? So I tried like creating a task and at first I wasn't able to. It was like I had to fill in like this whole like payload or whatever, I have a discovery document, but you see, like, you still don't know what to, like, put in there, right? So you can have the comments can kind of hint at you of what putting there, but still, you still have to guess the parameters half the time. So I was trying a bunch, but I wasn't able to do it. But I noticed, like, I was constantly getting invalid argument, which is a generic error. Worst. But I looked at the workflow execution log that I leaked earlier, and I saw, like, there was, like, some client ID default there. Like, I'm not sure what that means. So I just copied that and pasted it, and it just worked. So I was able to create this workflow.
Wow, right? Nice.
So once I had the workflow, I mean, I was trying to, okay, can I just run this workflow now? But no, it's not that easy. When I try to run it, it tells me, oh, no, you have to publish it first, right? And when I try to publish it, it tells me, oh, sorry, the publisher can't be the same as the last editor. So this kind of stopped me because I thought that, oh, and it was even saying something like, oh, you have to raise a request for approval. Like, what does that mean? Mm. Do I have to, like, send in some Googler and have them approve it? They're not going to approve it for me. So yeah, like I kind of hit a roadblock there. I was trying a bunch of different stuff to kind of bypass that, but I was really stuck here. So I was stuck here for maybe like a month, right? Literally like a month. And because of that original report that I did, right? When I initially just leaked the workflow execution logs. So they're already like starting to patch out all these endpoints. So that was like a big problem for me. But anyways, like I was in some random like Discord chat, like just out of nowhere, right? I just happened to ask like another like researcher in the same Discord group, that like, hey, do you need any protobufs or anything? Because I have like an endpoint. I can just get any protobuf for you. Because they didn't like fully patch it yet.
Right.
And then it turns out this guy had the exact same thing. Like I was like, what? What are the odds of that? Like some random guy in a chat has the exact same endpoint. And then we started DMing. I was like, is it the Cloud CRM API? Yeah, it's the same API. And we realized we were stuck at like two different points. Okay, so he was kind of looking at it a whole different aspect. I didn't even like think of this. So he realized that this API, right, is very similar to this product called application integration, which is like the public GCP product, right? This is like the internal version of it. And he was looking into this application integration a lot. So he found these same endpoints from the JS files of that product. Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah. Where did you find this guy, dude?
Like, I just introduced him like not that long ago by some friends.
Gosh, dude, that's crazy.
And it just happened to be.
It's not even like in yeah, like it's,
the there's, there's a lot. Yeah. There's a lot of that's sub nice. Communities, Justin. A little sub hacker groups, you know.
Yeah.
And Brewcat, you acted like that was kind of an anomalous like thing that you all had found the same thing. But literally every time I messaged you with something, you're like, oh yeah, I already know that. I've already seen that.
Yeah, same. So it's like, yeah,
I'm pretty sure that's not that uncommon that there's an intersection there finding the same thing.
Yeah, but you know, but it's different when it's us to Brutecat versus Brutecat to other
that's
people.
True.
You know what I'm saying?
That's true.
Like,
that's true.
You gotta give credit where credit's due here. Okay, so this is the internal version of the public service for running these application integration tasks.
Yeah, exactly. So I was looking more into it. So he was able to, but he couldn't figure out how to create the workflow because he didn't know that client ID default thing, right? Because he wasn't able to leak the whole workflow execution log or whatever that I was able to do. He was trying to like different parameters. He just never created the workflow. It kept saying invalid argument. But I knew how to create the workflow. But he knew how to kind of get past that because he was super like, he knew this whole product like in the back of his head. He completely knew application integration, but I didn't know anything about it. So I sent him like, we compared notes. I sent him exactly how to create the task, right? And then we were working together. So, okay, so at this point, we had a bit of a problem. So while I could create the task before, right, I can't actually do that anymore because they patched the endpoint, right? It's just the return permission denied because of the patches of the initial bug that I reported. So we were trying to see like what ways we can do around it. So for some weird reason, this API is kind of weird. I've never seen this before, but they have like duplicate endpoints. So they have like, let's say get proto definition, and then that one's blocked, but workflow support / get proto definition, that one works.
What?
Fine.
Why? Like, and all these were in the discovery doc?
Yeah, all of them. They're all the discovery doc.
Wow.
So yeah, so I found that, but the problem was the only endpoint that didn't have a counterpart was the create workflow one. Ugh. So we were screwed. Mm. Yeah, so we were literally stuck here. But then I sent the thing to like Shrug because he was like messing around with it. And somehow he created the workflow. I was like, what? Like, it doesn't work for me. How does it work for you? So then we realized that like the fix wasn't like rolled out to all the Google servers. Mm. So like he was from Canada, right? So it worked for him, but not for me because I'm from Singapore, right? So that was super interesting. So he was able to like reproduce it super easily. He's able to create the task. Then we realized that, okay, he sent me like, so Google has like this their DNS system is kind of interesting. So depending on like which IP address you resolve like www.googleaps.com, it like returns like some like a different IP address, right? And this IP address is linked to like a, they call it like a 1e100.net domain. So it's like something.1e100.net. So basically he sent me his 1e100.net domain and I put it into my like burp or whatever, the target, and I was able to do it easily. So then we were like figuring out like this whole like thing to create this task.
So that way you can sort of pin what host is dealing with your request. So you can bypass.
Okay, it's not as direct as that. Yeah. It's just kind of like you can pin it to a specific country, I would say.
Okay.
It's not like a specific server.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
So yeah, anyways, we were trying to figure out like how can we like publish this now. So he realized that we could like add like a different Gaia to some add ACL endpoint. Like I didn't even notice this. I don't know why. But he could like add a different Gaia there. Then you could use that Gaia to approve your own integration or your own like workflow or whatever. And then you can like publish it. And then we ran the workflow and it actually executed.
Oh my gosh, dude. You must have been so like hype when that happened.
The adrenaline rush was crazy.
I'm sure you just at that point you just like flip your desk and you're like, oh my gosh. So what's crazy to me though is that he knew, you know, how to change that access control, that ACL. And I'm trying to find it. I've got this, you know, the write-up open here. But it was like a pretty obscure key that he needed for that. So I'm very curious how he came up with that key. But I guess that's a little part of
the magic. He was just guessing.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah, we're just playing around, right? Trying to see what works.
Wow. Yeah. And I guess there's probably maybe these set of strings as well in the application integration app in Google Cloud. So maybe he's kind of taking some of the stuff from there and then trying it on this, you know, internal version.
Exactly. Right. And actually another thing is for the stubby task, right, we had to fill up the parameters for it. So it wasn't as easy as just like executing the task. Like, what do I put inside this task? There's no documentation I can refer to for the parameters. So we actually figured out that the public application integration, if you tried to configure the task there, it wouldn't work, but it would like leak this, like the parameters. It would tell you, oh, you need this like server spec, or you need this method parameter. So using that, we were able to slowly piece out exactly what we needed for the request. Then we also figured out, like, we looked through like random discovery documents and we were able to find like some random GSLB address, like GSLB alkali base. That's the one we used. And like, so Ezequiel Pereira, if you remember, like I mentioned him,
right?
He had this like RCE from super long ago. So we look at the write-up for that and we just like took some random like stubby method. I think we used like a server status on get services.
Yeah.
Right. So we took that and we tried it. And that's how we managed to get the whole thing working.
Dude. Wow. Yeah.
Wasn't there some other bug or something, Justin, at one of the live hacking events we were at where someone used a GSLB address and they had to like also find it or...
Dude, like I don't know. To be honest, that is so far over my head with some of this stuff. I don't think I even remember it. So that is really impressive that you guys were able to piece that together. I guess I need to go back and review some of this guy's you know, YouTube videos or talks and stuff like that, because there's gold there if you know where to look, apparently. So
For listeners that don't understand, like GSLB is Google Service Load Balancer. Mm-hmm. It's like their internal like DNS sort of thing where you can sort of reach to a specific host. So Alkali Base is like this. Okay, so Alkali is Google's internal framework for like creating APIs. So these APIs tend to be super insecure. It's like this. It's like an easy way for a Googler to spin up an API.
It's like, right? A dev
so
thing.
So historically, they've had like so many bugs. Mm. But yeah, we just happened to find this one address. I mean, it could have worked for different ones. But yeah, so we had this working, but like, and we sent in the report to like Google, but they like told it like just 1 hour after we sent the report. So we realized that like everything stopped working because the fix is fully rolled out. So if we had done this like 1 hour later, wow, we wouldn't have been able to prove anything.
No way.
That's crazy.
Dude. It was super clutch.
That is.
Yeah. For stuff clutch like this, I can't help but think, and some of the stuff we're going to talk about later today with like the reports you put in, like some of the write-ups you have are like, you know, 3 reports covered this and paid out a total of, you know, $30,000 or whatever. How do you decide kind of where, like on Google specifically, where to draw the line with like, why would you throw it all in one report versus why would you kind of break it up? Because like this one, like I'm curious, like once you all got that stubby RPC call working, did you just throw it on the report you already had or did you all submit another report? You know, I'm just really curious how your mind thinks about like when to combine them versus when to report them separately for Google's program specifically.
So that's actually a really good question. So you have to be kind of careful here. So generally, okay, I would say in this specific case, if I tried making a different report, they would kind of like lump it all together because it's the same API, right? So there's no point of making a different report. It's going to get duped. Like the previous report's going to get duped or something, or the new one might get duped. So if it's the same API and if the API is pretty small, like it's just a couple of methods here, like I would like to think that you should probably just do it in the same report. But if it's a pretty big API, like maybe like 100 plus methods, I would split it up into different reports. I mean, it's really nuanced. It's hard to like tell straight away. You could be losing out on bounties. Like in this case, like that initial bug I reported, I don't think they paid for that. They just like the RCE like overrode and everything. Mm. So you have to be a bit careful there.
Wow. Yeah, dude, it's a little tricky, man. I'm running into this a little bit with Google too, is like they actually do pretty decent due diligence when you submit your report sometimes, you know, and they'll fix stuff that's adjacent and you know, similar root cause stuff. So a lot of that stuff will end up getting duped back. But I also feel like, just as a critique of the Google program, I feel like that is not incentivized as well for you to like prove full impact across multiple different environments, right? So if you've got, you know, 8 different things that are vulnerable here, you're not really, they don't incentivize you outlining that in your report very well, you know?
Exactly. That's super well said.
Yeah. So I would like for them to, I would like to see either a multiplier, you know, they do multipliers for their report quality, which I think is a super important thing to do. And they do multipliers for other stuff, but then I think they're sort of, on the fly, you know, at will, extra bonus that they can add for things like, you know, having multiple instances that are vulnerable, is very limited, you know, a grand or two. So I definitely think a multiplier would be there. So it would be better there so that it kind of encompasses the impact that you can have if you've got a massively, you know, critical vulnerability that spans multiple different, you know, API endpoints or services.
So generally in such cases, right, what I actually do, if I find like 2 different bugs and like, let's say I find the first one I reported, but the second one doesn't help me get any additional impact.
Yeah.
Like it's just another different issue. So I'll actually just not report the second one. I'll wait till they fix the first one. Then I'll report the second one. Yeah. And that always works out.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think if anybody's listening and thinks that that's like weird or offensive, this is like exactly like you want to create a system. Like we should all work towards creating systems that like encourage the most ethical behavior, you know? And so like, you know, I would tell Google or, and I know people that do this same exact thing on HackerOne programs and BugCrowd programs. This isn't exclusive to Google. Like hackers are obviously going to try to provide the most for their family that they can, you know? And so that's the way the system should be set up. And so, you know, what should actually happen there is you should be able to report both of those and they treat them independently or whatever, you know, especially if they're separate fixes, which they obviously were because you just proved that by waiting. Right.
Right.
So,
yeah, and you give them the opportunity to realize that, hey, maybe the due diligence isn't always done as well as it should be, right? So you know, you shouldn't always dupe these back, right? because look, now I've just reported another adjacent service and that is, you know, not fixed, right? And so, yeah, I think that pokes holes a little bit in the, like, we're going to do our root cause analysis sort of situation. And you know, in my experience, I've done that. And I've been, you know, I've gotten another bounty for it and I've also gotten burned by it. You know, like I've submitted a bug and they fixed all of the adjacent ones as well, you know, and I was like, okay, well, they did do their due diligence this time. But then I've also, you know, reported it another one later and then they haven't fixed it. So it is a little bit of a roll of the dice, but I think it's the best way to show exactly whether the root cause analysis that they're doing is producing the results that it should, right?
I know this doesn't always work, but for the most part, what you should try to do, at least for Google, is, I mean, at least for now until they change this, but you should try to find as much impact as possible, right? So like, even that means like sitting on it for like a day or two, just try to find as much impact as possible, report the most impactful thing and that's it, right? So then you can like wait and report those like less impactful stuff if they don't patch it. So that way you can like save yourself.
Yeah, I totally agree. So you know, calling that service list on the prod probably got to be such a crazy moment. You must have been so hype. But that's not the end of the story here. So tell me how this continues to get another crazy bug out of Google.
Okay, so when I first saw this RCE, I was super tempted to like play around with it and stuff. Like, oh, can I like do stuff? But yeah, I was quickly told that no, I should just like stop touching this.
Right.
But yeah, so I had to leave it there. So I was kind of sad because I really wanted to try all these like internal like RPCs or whatever. I've collected them over like, I guess like the year or whatever that I've been hunting Google. So I wanted to play around with them, but no, I couldn't. But anyways, it's fine. I was like working on a bunch of other stuff, right? And like maybe like 3 months later, I was like improving my scanner and I was targeting Google Cloud at this point. So along with the Google Cloud APIs. And for some reason, this integrations, application integration like popped up again. So my scanner figured out like there was this problem across the whole application integration API. So you could like put /project/your project number, but reference someone else's UUID and it just works. Mm. It's like some super dumb IDOR. Mm. And this works like for all the APIs in this whole, like all the endpoints in this whole integrations API, right? But the problem is, how do you get this ID? Because this ID is like a UUID, right? So I was kind of screwed here. So I tried, because if you just report this by itself, it's not going to be too impactful, I'll say, because there's no way to prove to get that UUID. So they're going to downgrade it a lot. So I was saying, okay, is there any way I can sort of leak this UUID, right? So I was looking through like the whole application integration, and this is where I was like really playing around with it. So I saw there's like this feature called like test cases. So you can create a test case for your integration. So okay, just for anyone who doesn't understand, application integration is kind of just like no code, like automation workflow. So you can like drag and drop stuff and like connect them together. So let's say I take something from like one place and send it to another place. So that's kind of how this application integration works. So they have a test case feature where you can create a test case for a specific integration. So I can test just this one part of this integration, like this is like a send email task work. So I can create a test for that and like test that. But this test case thing was super weird. So when I created my test case, I looked at like how it was listing the test cases. So it was like some RPC, list test cases. But I decoded like the protobuf because it was sending in protobuf. And I saw it was sending like workflow ID equals to, and then my workflow ID, like as like some filter. But why is that client side? That should be like server side, right? So that was super weird. Then I was like, okay, so surely if I like remove this filter, it's not going to dump everybody's things, right? So I just removed the whole filter and it just dumped like the test cases for everybody in the whole GC,
right? Who uses this product? Crap, dude. That response size on that must have been massive.
Okay, so yeah, it was pretty massive. Like, but it was like some, I think there was like a page size or something. So I had it set as like 1,000. Oh, okay. But yeah, I got a super big response and I instantly know like something was wrong. And I could see all these like at google.com because it's like all these Googlers have made like their own integrations.
Oh no, that's crazy, dude. Oh my gosh.
I would definitely have just submitted it there. It's really funny to me that you're like, no, I need to get this UUID out.
Oh yeah, I'm not going to like, I don't want to stop there because it's not going to be a good bounty, right? I want to escalate the impact as much as possible. Right, until before I report. So I was trying to see, okay, can I get the UID from this? Because now I leaked all the test cases, right? It should be in the path, but for some reason there's like a dash there, like where my like UID, the UID is supposed to be. It wasn't showing it. So I was kind of stumped here, like because I thought I could stump it and get it working, but no. So I was trying to see, okay, what way can I have around this? Okay, so right now what I can do is I can list all the test cases. I can execute the test cases using the test case ID with the same dash as the integration UID, but I can't actually get the whole integration because I can't get the integration UUID, if that makes sense. So I was trying to see how I can leak that. But then I realized, wait, can't I just use the same filter parameter as earlier and then just do like a binary search on that? So I can fix it to a known test case. Then I can just use binary search and like keep trying all the different stuff until I can leak out the whole UUID off that, like of the guy who owns the test case.
Wow, does that make sense? Dude. Yeah, that makes sense. Frick, I love that, man. I love those filter injection, you know, filter-based binary search things. Those are amazing. It feels so good when you pull that off, man. Oh my gosh. Yeah. I love it.
No, literally. So I had Claude like write up the whole script and it just did it like first try. And I could see like the little animation of it, like slowly brooding it. It was awesome.
Yeah, like, oh my so, gosh. Dude, I haven't had one of those since Claude has been around. But I do remember the last time I coded one up manually, and I finally, the last time I did it, you know, it required a bunch of weird, you know, statements in there with like different parentheses to get the order of operations correct. And it was like, when it finally, you know, you could tweak one variable and it would, you know, show yes or no, I was like, oh my gosh, yes. So it's amazing.
I would have never thought to use this on a UUID for some reason. Yeah. Like I just wouldn't think of it as being something that could be binary searched with like greater than, less than, but clearly it can.
No, because it's the same filter AIP thing, right? Mm-hmm. It's all the same thing.
Yeah.
So you could use the same logic there and do the binary search. I mean, I was stuck here for a bit. It took me like maybe like a day to figure out this whole binary search thing. I don't think even Claude figured it out. Like I had Claude like working on this. Like, can you try to escalate this impact? Can you try to like see if there's any way we can leak it. But I had to manually figure this out. But yeah, so once I had this working, I got the UID. I was able to then do IDORs across this whole thing. So I could just take over some guy's integration. I can like view all their integrations. I can do all this kind of stuff. But see, remember earlier, right? Those test cases had like at google.com or something. So I was thinking, what if like there was like these internal integrations or whatever, but they're using this application integration, but they're using some sort of internal task type, right? Can I like somehow like use that and like steal their integration and execute that task type? So I was trying to see in that angle, right? But I had to be a bit careful as well, because you have to draw a line, right? I can't iterate through customer data, because they're not gonna accept the report. So I had to send everything I had so far and just tell them to look for it. But like I wasn't satisfied with that. Like I don't want them to look for it. I wanted to find it myself. So I was looking deeper. So what is exactly stopping me from creating my own integration? If I try to create an integration with like the same stubby type task, what is stopping me from doing that? So I tried it out and I was actually able to create the integration. But when I try to execute this integration, it will just like time out. Like it'll just say, oh, like this thing is timed out after like 120 seconds and it doesn't say anything else. So it's kind of vague. But I looked at the same test case feature. What if I create a test case for my stubby integration and then execute that test case? So okay, at first I was playing around with all the different internal task types. I wasn't even playing around with stubby. I was doing some weird Python task or something. So I was trying that Python task. Then I got some like super like, so when I pressed the play button for playing the test or test case I just made, I got some super suspicious like error, like insufficient like disk space or something. Like it looked like some like Linux error, the standard Linux error when you ran out of like space in your box. So I was like, what is going on here? There's something weird here. So yeah, I was looking at like, okay, so this is probably reaching some sort of like execution backend, right? Yeah, I think that's the error here. Oh no space left the device.
Gosh, dude. What? No space left? Yeah, Java IO exception, no space left on the... This is the sketchiest thing ever. Wow.
And it was showing the UI as well, like a big red like notice. Oh, like no space left on the device.
Oh my gosh.
So yeah, then I was like, okay, can I try the stubby one? But the stubby one would just give me some like super generic error, like unknown error. And that's it. Like it doesn't tell me anything else. But I figured out, right, I could look at the workflow execution logs and that had like a stack trace. So I fetched the whole stack trace and I got some, I saw super suspicious error. Like it was like Uber Mint verification failed. So like it had an RPC security policy error and it had a bunch of stuff like that. So this error in Google usually means that like the product counter that you're trying to reach doesn't have like a RPC security policy defined for the RPC you're trying to hit. So like it's not whitelisted for the RPC or something. So because it's a different product account than the other one, right? This is like a completely different product account. So I'm guessing this one didn't have access to Alkali Base or whatever I was trying here. So this already told me that it's definitely hitting like stubby. So I checked with like Sam if I could like escalate this anymore, like if I can try to keep testing this, right? Then they checked it and it was fully exploitable. So I had to stop everything here.
Wow, dude, look at that. Execute stubby call. Oh my gosh. That is beautiful. And they said, all right, back off. We'll take it from here. Dude. Wow.
You have to be super careful. Like if you, I've heard of this, like this is a rumor going on around like whatever, where some guy like took his RCE too far and then they voided the whole thing. So I don't play too much. I better just report this and let them deal with it. So, but I was looking at like the stack trace. You could kind of see like how the source code works because like it leaks out everything in the stack trace. So I kind of like figured out like how it's like setting this different parameters and stuff. So yeah, I reported this. I didn't hear back for like almost a month. So I was at this point, I was like wondering like, why is it taking so long? Because the other one like was rewarded in just a few days. But it turns out, right, this one got 75,000. So there's like the three different tiers in Google's like VIP rewards. So 50,000 is for like a sort of unprivileged production user, right? But if you get 75,000, that means it's a highly privileged like production user.
Wow.
And 100K would be like complete like admin in Google Cloud, right? And see, in many cases, in my opinion, right, even if you have an unprivileged user or whatever, you can usually like privilege escalate to like different RPCs and stuff, but they won't let you test that, obviously, but it's definitely probably possible. So they just look at like, I guess, the permissions of the product account. But in this case, like I was speaking to Kote, right? They're super vague about this. They won't tell me more about this, even though I keep like pressing them on this. But apparently there's some sort of like escalation that even I didn't show here that you could do and you can get even more impact. So that's why they rewarded the 75K tier.
Wow, dude. Very, very cool. That is quite a story. And I think probably this is the longest intro bug that we've ever had in the history of critical thinking.
But totally worth it. But completely, totally worth
it. Totally worth it, man. Absolutely inspiring.
A double RC on Google.
Yeah. Dang.
No big deal.
That's insane. So I did take some notes and I do have some questions to go back to on this. But before we do that, I do want to give you the proper introduction. As we mentioned, guys, this is Broodcat. You can get his on his blog at broodcat.com. It's on Twitter. It's just at Broodcat, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And you're also doing some consulting now, right? Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah. I mean, I've just recently started like doing a bunch of, I set up my own company, Broodcat Security. So you can just go to broodcat.com/hunt if you want me to pen test your stuff. I have a whole like AI thing, the same AI that I use for pen testing Google, right? Mm. I've kind of like worked that out for pen testing other companies as well. And I've had tons of success with that. So if you want me to run it on your company, just feel free to reach out.
Nice, dude. That's awesome. And yeah, I mean, this guy is the pinnacle of Google hacker. Like just, I've read all of his blogs multiple times. So dude, really excited to have you on the pod.
Let me blow everybody's mind real quick.
Yeah.
Literally out here, I was telling my wife that we were coming to interview you. Yeah. And I was like, yeah, this guy's amazing. He's been hacking Google for forever. He's like one of the goats. And then I see it in our doc, how I got into Google mid 2024.
What the
heck? Mid to late 2024. No, in my head, for some reason, you're like this like always epic Google hacker that's been around for 10 years. And I'm like, wait a second. He started hacking Google 2 years ago. What am I doing in my life?
Exactly, dude.
So
exactly. Yeah. That's how I feel too. Yeah, well, it's funny you mentioned your wife, because I said the same thing to my wife and she knew who he was because I talked about his research before to her. I was like, yeah, man, this guy, Broodcat, he came up with this crazy way to like let me access Google APIs a little bit better. So that's pretty funny, man. Going back to the write-up. So I wanted to ask you a couple things. One, you mentioned that you were using your AI to guess the parameters for these requests, right? So what sort of additional information have you given Claude to enable it to do these guesses correctly? And how do you get it normalized to your account, like where you have different objects created and that sort of thing?
Okay, I could touch on this now, but probably be better if I talk at this later, okay, because I have a whole
thing I can probably cover it in that section. Whole,
yeah, we should probably cover it then.
Okay, let's do that then. And then the other thing that I had here, you already covered GSLB, but the Google SRE handbook is quoted multiple times in this, in this write-up. I mean, have you just read this whole thing cover to cover?
I've read it like 5 times. I mean, the first time I read it, I didn't know anything. Like, but I kept reading again and again. And not just this. So I read a bunch of stuff. Mm. Like I would read like Beyond Prod and their whole documentation there. Like they documented so much stuff.
Yeah.
I've even read about like as much stuff as I can, all different papers about like, because Google releases a lot of these papers and it's about their whole internal infrastructure. If you can like read that and learn it and bring those tips into the hunting, it's actually super beneficial. Mm. Mm.
Yeah, there's just so much to figure out with Google because it is architected very much, different from any other company that I've seen. Okay, so the Google SRE handbook, you mentioned something called Beyond Prod. And then do you have any other resources that you really gained, got a lot out of when prepping for, I guess, hacking Google infrastructure?
I would say that, okay, they do have like some papers on like Chubby or these kind of like internal stuff, but mostly just these two resources that you mentioned.
Okay.
Those are the, if you just want to get started, you should be reading this. Those are like the minimum requirement.
Okay. Nice. Well, I'm going to go get those. go read through those. Cause I have referenced the Google SRE handbook a couple times, but I haven't actually like read it cover to cover. So I think I'll have to go back and do that. Sweet, man. Well, that was a whirlwind. So just a couple of takeaways from that write-up. If you're using client 6 and first party auth and you're getting a protobuf response, or you're not getting a protobuf response out and you think you should be, then you can use the Google encoded response if executable header to get it out as base64. You've got the whole request proto. We did sort of a head nod to that, you know, because you found Request a Proto as a Service there. But there's this whole primitive, essentially, gadget that you've outlined on your blog about how to do an error-based oracle to leak the JSON, the proto-JSON request structure for these Google APIs requests. And we should be on the lookout for anything related to Stubby. No matter if you see Stubby, you need to like lock in because there could be some really impactful stuff there.
And it should be said that Request to Proto is also a project on his GitHub.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. Yeah. Beautiful, beautiful project. Anything else that you think we should have as takeaway from that write up?
I think it's pretty well said. And like you mentioned, if you see any sort of Stubby, right, mm-hmm. you should try to find a way to reach that. Mm-hmm. Like there's so many like potential RCs. In fact, right, if you look at all the discovery documents, if you try to grep for Stubby, you'll find a bunch of like stuff like there. And you can grep for like GSLB, grep for these kind of keywords mm-hmm. and see if there's anything referencing that. Because that could potentially be a way you can get access to this, right? And they have so many like webhooks, like random Stubby webhooks. I'm guessing the Googlers made it to make their life easier, mm-hmm. but the same thing can be used for us hackers, right? Mm-hmm. So you want to try to find as many of those as possible. And in fact, it may not even be in the discovery document directly. It could be like embedded inside some service. Let's say you're hacking on some GCP product, right? And maybe you got access to like the tenant project or something, and you have a shell or something. If you see anything inside there that's referencing Stubby, that could be another thing, oh, right? Yeah. It doesn't have to be in a discovery document.
Because they've got to tape this. They've got to tape everything back together with these RPC calls, right? So if you've got any sort of primitive, you know, inside of you know the shell in your own org in that product, and that thing can do anything. Right, you know, then it needs to tie back out to RPC calls at the end of the day. And if they don't do that in a secure way, then you could get arbitrary RPC call execution. Very interesting. And then the last call out that I had here that I did forget in my notes was take a look at the AIP 160 filtering spec and just realize that that is something that is used pretty widely across Google because you can run into these bugs where you can create these, you know, filter binary searches, or at least, you know, be able to notice when there is a filter being used and you might be able to use that to access other people's information.
One takeaway I had, which I always associated with like old Yahoo stuff is just is the whole load balancer thing.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I don't think that people should intentionally try everything like from different regions or 100 times or whatever. But I do think if you ever try something and it works and then you're, you know, later on you're trying to reproduce and it doesn't work, you can think about the fact that, oh, maybe it's because I was connected to a VPN, or maybe, you know, if it's working for a buddy and not for you, you know, it may be due to the fact that it's going through like a different load balancer.
Yeah. I need to send this request. Like,
yes, yeah, so exactly. See, the way Google does their request, right? It's like when they do a fix, let's say you report a bug and they fix it. Like, the fixes roll out gradually. It's not like an instant rollout for many cases, right? So if you can use this trick usually and find like some host or something that you can use to route the request through and reach a server that hasn't had that fix rolled out yet. So this is like a way to kind of bypass it temporarily.
Very nice, man. Very nice.
Cool.
All right. So let's jump into how you got into Google VRP. And it starts with a obsession with YouTube, it looks like, which I think many people can relate to. So give us that story.
Okay. So it wasn't necessarily obsession with YouTube, but that was pretty related, mm-hmm. but it was mostly an obsession with like OSINT stuff. So I was a complete noob, by the way. Like I didn't know like anything what was going on. Like I just wanted to, I thought it was super interesting that these like OSINT tools existed where you can sort of like find out information of any guy you wanted, mm-hmm. right? So I wanted to see, like Google was pretty interesting because everyone has a Google account pretty much, right? Like I don't think there's a single person that doesn't have a Gmail, right? So if you can somehow like leak information off the Gmail, like maybe they have a maps review or like a play review or something, that'd be pretty, it's pretty fun, right? So I was looking into this, right? And I saw this like this random website, like, okay, I think it was called like OSINT Industries or something, but this website was pretty funny because you could input an email and it would find the YouTube channel tied to the email. Mm. So I was like, how does that work? Because I'm like, how can you dox me from that?
You're like that's a bug. Like, you're like, I know, that's a bug, right?
Yeah.
So yeah, like a lot of these OSINT stuff like relates to actual bugs. But yeah, I was like kind of super interested in this. I was like super obsessed with it. I was trying to figure it out. Then eventually I think I went to some like super ancient like Discord server for this guy. And I saw some screenshot that he like sent. And inside there's like a pot of his like home directory or something. He had some terminal open and you could see the path there. And it said something about a profile card. So I was like, okay, this has to be related to this, because he was talking about that whole YouTube thing like right before this. So then I was like, okay, what is a profile card? I looked through everything to try to like find like profile card references. And turns out profile card is like some super weird like YouTube feature. So if you have like okay, first it was only for mobile. If you went to like YouTube, any sort of YouTube video or the comment section, and you tap on the profile there, it would like load this kind of like mini card and you can like see subscribe or whatever, right? So this is called a profile card. So it didn't exist in the web yet, but I was curious how it worked. So I set up like a whole, like I read some like tutorial or something, and I set up a whole like on my iOS phone, I could like sniff the traffic, right? Through like Burp. And then I was like looking through all the different requests, and it was in protobuf, so I couldn't read it, but I noticed the ID there looked a lot like a Gaia ID, which is like a Google account identifier. So I was like, so I could just pass in any Gaia ID here and it's just going to return the YouTube channel. And it worked. But I was also thinking, if it's able to do that, how is it getting the Gaia ID, right? Because surely it's getting it from somewhere. And then I looked more into it, and it turns out whenever you load the comments of any like channel or page or whatever, it had the Gaia ID of every single user like tied to that.
Oh my God.
See, the thing is, Google, they have two different types of Gaia IDs. They have an obfuscated focus Gaia ID, right? So it was focus obfuscated Gaia ID, foggy, that's what they call it. But they also have an unobfuscated Gaia ID, right? So like the raw Gaia ID. But the thing is, see, many teams, the teams across Google, they think that they can just safely release this obfuscated one. But the truth is that you can many times convert this obfuscated one to an email, or like convert this obfuscated one to fetch like some other information. So it's like it's an issue with across the teams at Google, because Google is so big, right? They don't realize that one team thinks it's like it's not safe. The other team thinks it's perfectly fine. So they did a massive screw up here. Like, in fact, you could probably go to Wayback Machine and look through that. I bet you would find a Gaia ID stuff like so many channels there. So yeah, this was interesting. But so I had this for a while. I built it to my like little tool or whatever. I could like sort of do that. But I didn't even think of it as like a bug. Like I wasn't even trying to find bugs, to be honest. Like hacking Google in particular. But I was just trying to find these OSINT stuff. But then I noticed they rolled out this fix to they rolled out like this feature at the web. So instead of the web, you can tap on it. And a ton of people found the same thing, because it's super easy to like see the request on the web as compared to iOS, right? So then they started rolling out the patches for this. Like instead of they stopped like supplying the Gaia ID, they started like doing some like channel ID or something instead. Like the reason why it was a Gaia ID to begin with is because this comments backend in YouTube is like from G plus days. So back in the day, like they didn't want to like lose those comments that were made in the G plus days. So it's still a Gaia ID backend. Like your comments are tied to your Google account. It's still tied to your YouTube channel. So if you move your YouTube channel to a different Gaia account, it's gonna lose all the comments because it's all tied to this.
Interesting.
So yeah, I was looking at that, and then I was able to, yeah, so they sort of patched the whole thing. And then I was like kind of stumped. Like I wanted to find like another way to do it. So I was looking through like all the APIs like with a friend, and we were trying to see like, is there any other way we can like leak these Gaia IDs? And we figured out like there was this one like endpoint. If you had a live chat and you like tap the three dots on like the side of like a live chat, like on a live chat viewer, let's say they write a message, you tap the three dots there. It like opens this context menu, like you can block the guy or report the guy or something. And this block functionality, like how does the block work there? Because like what does a block mean? If I block a guy here, is it blocked across all of Google? Because then is it tied to the guy ID? So turns out if you block the guy and then you look at your list of blocked people through the people API, it just listed the guy ID there. So you just had another way to do
it. Dude, that is such a good trick. And I've used that multiple times. I think I actually shouted it out on the pod a couple weeks ago. But like going through that like abuse report functionality to de-anonymize people is super clean. And it works almost every time I've ever tried it. That's a big, you know, sort of conceptual takeaway that spans multiple targets, I think.
So yeah, then I was looking at like how this thing worked and the request wise, right? And it turns out you don't even need to block the guy. Like if you just open the three dots, it's like it preloads the guy ID of the guy. And it was even worse because you don't even need a live chat message. You can just change the channel ID to whatever channel ID and it just returns the guy ID.
Really?
Right?
So, oh, wow.
Yeah, at this point I had the guy ID, but like how could I get more impact? Like sure, you can list like the maps reviews or like the play reviews or whatever, but I want to get the email of this
guy.
Wait a second.
Just clarifying. You said he doesn't even need to comment. You can just change the channel ID and it drops the Gaia of every viewer.
So okay,
what do you mean about change the channel ID?
Say it again.
I said, what do you mean by change the channel ID, Brookhart?
Okay, so pretty much in the three dots, right? If you just tap on that, it loads this context menu for that user, right? So you can just change a user ID to any user at the whole YouTube. It'll just load the three dots for that user. Does that make sense?
Oh, he's saying in the request that gets sent when you hit the three dots, if in that request you just change it to the channel ID, aka the user ID of any user, then it will just immediately respond with the guy ID.
I see. Okay. Gotcha. That makes sense. Continue.
There's always so much assumed knowledge whenever you're interviewing experts. Like when you say channel ID, to me, I'm thinking like channels that people publish from. But you know, everyone on YouTube has their own channel ID because like, and so anyways, yeah.
Exactly.
Right.
It's funny.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, I had this like primitive or whatever. I could get the guy ID, but I wanted to see how I can escalate this further. So I was looking through like all the different apps in Google, because there's so many weird apps. They've had so many leaks before, like in the past, right? You could open like a, this is back when Google Hangouts existed. You could open a Hangouts chat with somebody and it takes in the Gaia ID and it just opens a chat with their email, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. So there's probably some leak out there. So I was looking through all the super old apps. Like I found this app, like Pixel Recorder. Okay, it was like this niche app where if you have like a Pixel phone, you can like have recordings and sync it to the cloud. So I had this app and I synced it to the cloud and I went to this like recorded a Google account or something. And at this point, like there was like a share functionality. So I just tested it out. Can I share, what if I share this recording? And it took in the obfuscated guy ID and it returned the email. Like it, because it adds a guy and then you could, this is the people added and it has email there. So now I had the full chain because I could just leak the guy ID, then leak the email, and now I have the email of any YouTube channel I want or any YouTube user for that matter.
Wow, dude, that's intense. So channel to Gaia, Gaia to email, right? So you get that chain and then you leak the email out. Wow.
That chain is like something that a seasoned bug bounty expert would report. And it's just his first Google bug.
Yeah, I know. Right. Yeah. Like that's such a crazy thing, dude. Very good work. Yeah. I think the OS int background really, that's a great transition, right? Because you're focused very literally on like leaking data that is useful, you know? So you don't get as many reports where you're like, oh, I can leak this, you know, completely unrelated thing. You're like, oh, okay. Email. Yep. That's useful for sure. So that's a
leak, leaking into top bug hunters seems to be such a clear route. Like there's obviously all the game leakers that have done the exact same thing on like Epic or Fortnite and stuff. Mm.
For sure. So then you just kind of, after this, looking at the doc, it kind of seems like you just went ham on YouTube, right?
Okay. But I'm not done with the story yet. So okay. it wasn't complete yet because, see, the problem with this Pixel recorder was when I shared the recording or something, it sent this super long email, oh, this guy has shared a like recording with you. So it's super like messy. Like, I don't want that, the victim seeing that. If the victim sees that, it lowers the impact so much, right? Like, and my OSINT tools, like, there's like this general rule in OSINT where like, if you have something that works, it shouldn't notify the guy. If it notifies the guy, it's like a red light. So I was trying to see, okay, is there a way I can like stop this notification? So I tried to see like, okay, like the parameters, there's no parameters to like not like uncheck like the notify, but I thought about it. Like what exactly is in the notification email, right? There's the title of the recording in the title of the subject of the email. And there's like the recording, like whatever description or something. But if the title probably has some sort of limit, right? If you reach a limit, it just probably won't send the email because so I just like wrote like a 1.2 million character like title and I created the Pixel recording. Then I shared it and there was no email.
I don't want you building OSINT tools for anyone, okay? Yeah, stick to Bug Bounty, buddy, because if there are OSINT builders who are out there who are as smart as you, they're going to be able to pull off some crazy stuff.
Yeah, wow. That is a good... I love how the solution could be that simple sometimes. You're just like, yeah, what if the email was really, really, really freaking big? You know,
This is making me regret so much. I feel like there's so many like sensitive actions that you can take on behalf of other users that are often like mitigated by basically notification emails. Yeah. And now I want to go back and retest all of those.
Totally.
Yeah. That was so smart.
Wow. Great finding, dude.
So at this point, I was like, okay, this is surely like a VRP like level bug. Like I should probably report this to Google. Like I don't think I should be having this. It looks too broken. So yeah, I looked into like how can like open like a security report or something. So I sent in the report. It was like a super like messy report. I didn't even know what I was doing. So I just wrote out like all the different steps of the how to get this working and I sent it off, right? So then eventually, so they took like quite a while to get back. I think it was like around like November or December of like 2024 or something like that. I don't remember the exact timeline, but something like that. So it took quite a while because it was like the holiday period, I guess. But eventually they got a nice cache. I had to like debug with the Triager. Like I think there was like some weird like case where the Triager wasn't able to actually test it, and it didn't work for him because he was trying to get the tree dots working for his own channel, which doesn't work because like you can't block yourself, you feel me? Like
right.
You can only block other people. So that just didn't work. But yeah, in the end we sorted it out and it got like a nice cache. So this was my very first like Google bug. Right. So this kind of got me into this whole thing. Like, and I think it was rewarded in the end, like 10K or something. Right. It was like pretty big bounty. I mean, so I was looking at more into this thing. I was still focused on OSINT. I didn't actually care about like VRP hacking entirely. So I was looking at, like I had this like database or whatever. I was like scraping a bunch of YouTube data because it was quite interesting to me getting all this big data stuff. Like, can I list all the comments of some guy? Right. Because if I scrape all the comments, can I like list all the comments from this specific channel, so or this user. So I was like doing that, and from doing that, I learned so much about Google APIs, right? So I think that knowledge was super valuable. So first of all, I figured out like what like protobuf and gRPC was. Like I could hit requests directly with gRPC. Like all this wasn't documented properly. Like I had to find some how to RPC like markdown page at like Google release, but even that didn't explain gRPC too well. Like there's a difference between proto over HTTP and gRPC. I was using gRPC itself because I wanted this to be as fast as possible. Because if you're doing it at the scale of like YouTube, it has to be fast. Then I figured out like, oh, there's like this header, xgook field mask. So I could just reduce it to exactly what fields I want, right? The comment text or whatever. And this is where I learned the 1e100.net trick, where you can load balance across like all YouTube or all different hosts in Google. So that way you're not like just hammering this one host. And Google also had like rate limits. But at this point, I figured out like, I was doing a lot of research and I realized that you can use IPv6, right, to bypass this whole rate limits. Because rate limits are normally per IP address for unauthenticated requests, right? But they didn't consider the fact that in IPv6, like IPs are super cheap. You can just get like a /64 or something, it has so many IPs, like billions of IPs, and you can just use that and rotate between each IP and then they can't stop you. Unless they do like a subnet ban. But at this point, that didn't exist. So you could just kind of do this and bypass the entire rate limits.
Wow, dude. Yeah, I remember back in the day when I was in the recon game, you know, there was this problem where you couldn't Google dork very effectively, you know, in an automated way. And the solution that we had to that back in the day was get a /64, you know, IPv6, and then use that to hit Google and do your search until it, you know, blocks you and then just rotate the IP. But I guess they've probably fixed that now with subnet bans.
Oh yeah, so the fix they have now is they do, I think it's like a layered approach. So if you try to use /64, they'll ban the /64. Then if you try to use a /48, like it slowly increases the subnet size of the ban. So that, I think that's a smart approach. Yeah. But I mean, it's still possible to get you can still rent out like a super big, like ISP level, like range or something. Or if you have a shared range with other customers, right, that could also be another way. Like it's super hard to block this. I don't think IP is a really good way to
rent. Yeah, I mean, you could just buy proxy rotation, right, through like some of those like more shady services, and it will just rotate every request through a bunch of different residential IPs, and you'll just never be blocked.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, that was kind of what I was working on. But through this whole process of trying to like how I could get as much information as possible from a YouTube channel, I was looking through all the APIs. So at this point, I found this Vector Proto thing, right? It's like this tool where I can use this JSON plus protobuf, and I can just probe like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Like I just send that in like array and send that to the server. It starts leaking a bunch of error messages, which tell me the whole protobuf message, right? So I can reconstruct the whole protobuf that the request has. So this leaks so many like internal things that would otherwise not be seen anywhere, right? So I was looking through all the channel endpoints, and I found this one endpoint, like the Git Creator channel. So if you go to your YouTube channel and you like, I think click on the Earn tab or one of the tabs, it like fetches information about your own channel, right? So it uses this Git Creator channels like endpoint. But you can also use this to fetch other people's channels, but for restricted fields. Like you can supply like specific like fields that you want to fetch, and it would only be like the public fields. So I was thinking, is there any sort of like parameter I can like use here? So I used the Vector Proto and I leaked all the parameters, and I saw some like include suspended is true. So that sounds like, okay, you would think it means the channels are banned, but that's not what it was. It just appended some random content owner association. I don't know what this was. So I was trying to figure that out. Like it added some content owner association with some ID, right? So I started looking into this. Okay, what is a content owner? And I went through this whole rabbit hole. So turns out like content owners are like this, so CMS accounts on YouTube. It's like this God mode account. They give it to a few enterprises and they essentially can strike anyone they want. They can like monetize any channel they want. They can claim your content. it's a super sensitive tool. So this tool or whatever can link channels to it, right? And this would leak the association with that tool. So, and the way like these rights management tools work a lot is they have like, if I'm like a big like company or whatever, and I want to contact another company, I need to like find your email or something to contact it, right? So they have this endpoint, like some endpoint to sort of like get the email of the other company, but it's just a conflict. It's like a notification email. Like you said, this as a public email. It's not like some sort of account email. You can put it as whatever, like at your company.com, right? So it's just intended functionality. But so this is required a CMS account to do it in the first place. But then I looked deeper into YouTube, right? And I realized that, you know, the copyright match tool that a lot of YouTube channels have, so you can see like other people claim your content. Like, how does that work? It's probably just content ID in the back end, right? So is it making a secret CMS account in the back end? And it sure was. So it made some like weird CMS account in the back end. It's like some, like, I guess they had to do that in order to make this hack work to get the content ID working for that. So then I realized that I can leak the ID of that, right? And what is the content, the notification email set for that account? Is it like, because you can't set that anywhere, right? And it turns out it goes to the account email of the YouTube channel.
Oh, nice, dude.
So I was able to do this whole chain. I could sort of leak this initial ID, then I could convert this ID and leak the conflict notification email, which would be the channel's email, and then I had the email for basically any YouTube partner I wanted to.
Wow, dude. Yeah, that is a good chain. So there's that aspect there of like, how does this value get populated when the account is created automatically? I like that. So that's just I'm always trying to take these principles and kind of bring them up to a higher level, I guess. So even in those situations where you can create, you know, let's say an email that's adjacent to the one associated with your specific account, if you can figure out a way for that to access it in its default state, right, before the user has set it, then that might be, you know, associated with the main account. That's very good. That is an awesome principle.
Exactly. Yeah. So that worked out here. So I think this got even higher bounty than the other one. I don't know. It's kind of confusing because, you know, their abuse VRP like caps out. The first one got rewarded as abuse, but this one got rewarded as like the normal VRP. So it got like 20K, but the other one was 10K. I mean, I don't know, man. Like, I feel like they should increase the rewards for the abuse.
Yeah, dude. I don't abuse. That's just me. That is one of the things that we've kind of bumped up against with them often. I'll share this situation that I had where, you know, I was able to enumerate the phone number for any Google account. And, but it was through essentially a brute force that is powerful across multiple requests, right? Like I can send, you know, 10,000 in one request. And so, you know, it was pretty low traffic. It was like, you know, 60 to 100,000 requests to leak a full, you know, 10 character phone number. But somehow that got put in abuse, even because of it's like brute forcing something. I'm like, but this, at the end of the day, it still leaks the same phone number. Like if there was an API that just responded with this phone number, then you would say it's Google VRP all day. But if I have to send, you know, 60,000 requests to leak it, you know, then it's abuse. I don't understand. It's a little bit of a weird setup they have there.
No, even if they wanted to do this, in my opinion, they should like match up the abuse rewards to be like equal to this, because you can have an abuse bug or whatever, a super high impact, yeah, right? Totally. Like you mentioned. So it doesn't make sense that the rewards are capped at like 13K or 10K or something, but the VRP on the other side, like Google VRP is not capped like that.
I
hate that, like which maybe this is only the Gen AI stuff, but the API keys that gave internal access to internal AI models historically were treated as like abuse API leaks, and they paid $500 for them. I will say the ones this year did pay better, but still for the type of impact there, again, I think that in Google VRP, it would have paid a lot more. Like if you could just like take over a Google account that had access to those same models, they would pay you like 50K, right? But because it's like an abuse bug, then it's like capped at like 9 or 10 or something.
We've had the Google team on here to talk about that in the past. And they're like, guys, abuse is for when, you know, Google VRP isn't going to pay you at all. And I'm like, see, I don't think that's true. Like, you know, because I don't think that you would not pay me to be able to link the phone number of any arbitrary Google account, right? Like, that doesn't make any sense. So I don't know. there's definitely some tweaking that needs to be done there. And I'll say, you know, I've said it on the pod, I'll say it again. I often, almost every bug, to be honest, push it back to Google, you know? And I would say a lot of time they do adjust the bounty at the end of the day after more rationale. But it is frustrating to me that I have to push it back every time and be like, no, this is this tier. No, this is this data sensitivity. No, this is not abuse. This is, you know, and it takes time, man. It's not a insubstantial amount of time that it takes to do these debates. So
it's super tiring as well, because like you report a bug and you think that it's just going to be smooth sailing, but no, you have to keep like fighting, I guess, and appeal it and talk back and forth. It's just super annoying. Like, you can't just report it and be happy. I think other like programs, I'm not too sure, but I'm pretty sure other programs would report the same thing as you mentioned as like a normal tier. It wouldn't be like abuse and then some lower payout. Yeah,
it's odd.
Dude, Justin, you were just talking about how you leak phone numbers, and then I scroll down here in the doc, and literally BirdCat has found the same thing back in early 2025.
Okay, all right.
But he didn't have to do it via some convoluted abuse way. He did it in a real way.
I don't know. There's an IPv6 bypass there. He might be brute forcing stuff too.
It's a brute force as well. Yeah. It's the same thing. No, but which year did you find it?
I found it.
Like super long ago?
I found it. It must have actually been late 2025. But mine was on.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So, Richard.
Oh, I know about that. No, but that's like.
Yeah.
That's like.
Yeah. Well, yes. Mute that too, please, Richard. But yeah. Yeah. So.
No, I knew about that. I just didn't report it because I didn't want to, like, because it was part of my OSINT thing where I could kind of, like, get that.
You burned his OSINT tool, Justin.
Sorry,
what are you doing?
I'm sorry. Well, I don't even. Who knows if they even fixed it because it's abuse, you know, but whatever. So, anyway, hit us with what you got for this phone leak.
Okay, yeah. So anyways, so this phone leak is for like the account recovery number, mm-hmm. right? So you could, basically everyone has this set pretty much. Mm-hmm. So I was looking through like the JavaScript, like all these the Google pages, right? For some reason, some of them worked without JavaScript, which is kind of odd to me. Because like in the modern web, right, you don't really see many things that work without JavaScript.
Right.
So I was just playing around with it. I wasn't expecting anything. So I went to the login page. The login page didn't work. But for some reason, this forget password, like the forget password page or something, it just worked, right? And it wasn't forget passwords, like forget username or something. Mm. Yeah, so this page just worked. And the forget username functionality is super interesting. So you can enter like a full name, right? And then you can enter like a phone number, and it tells you if it matches together. So is there an account which has this full name and this phone number? And it worked without JavaScript. So this was like a huge red flag, because if you think about it, JavaScript is how... Okay, so do you know what BotGuard is? Have you heard of it
before? Yeah, I've heard of BotGuard.
So it's like Google's like obfuscated proof of work, right? So they use this everywhere. They want to stop like botting, because the idea with it is like by the time you spend all this time to reverse it, like there's a new challenge already, and it takes super hard to reverse it, and you have to. It's a proof of work as well, so it takes a lot of compute power if you want to generate this token, right? So this is how they prevent it, but they can't do this without JavaScript. They need JavaScript to load the challenge, but everything seems to work without JavaScript. So that was super sus. Mm. And I knew a bunch of like these weird like login pages that worked with JavaScript as well. Like youtube.com/TV for the longest time, you could do a login without JavaScript, mm-hmm. but they patched that. But this one wasn't patched, right? So I was looking at it and I was thinking, okay, so can I just like brute force this? So, okay, this is something super interesting. Not many people realize this, but many services like PayPal, they leak like so many digits of your phone number. So if I go to paypal.com and if I do a password reset of your email, it'll like show me, oh, do you want to text this number? +165 and then just 4 digits censored. Everything else is revealed.
Right? I've never thought about how this is probably some super useful bit of information for OSINTers.
Yeah. Totally.
But yes, of course, we know exactly what you're talking about.
If you think about it, if you chain enough services, you could probably just leak the full phone number.
Right.
Yeah.
But even if not, if you're doing some sort of like node-based mapping of people, right? Because like that's obviously a big problem, is like linking profiles and stuff. Even those 3 digits might be useful enough to like link like 60% of profiles or something in like an OSINT database, which is kind of interesting.
Yeah, so I was looking at how this works. So I only need to brute 4 digits or something for the PayPal one. So, and that sounded super easy to do. So I wrote out some like script or something, and I was able to get it. So it worked. But then I wanted to see, okay, can I take it steps further? Can I just brute force the entire phone number, right? But at this point, there's a bunch of issues. Okay, so first of all, how do I know which country code your phone number is? Because it's so different formats, right? It could be like +1, it could be +65 for Singapore. But turns out if you look at like the password reset, like the just like some form that they write the phone number in, like a bunch of dots, a dots in a space and something like that, you can use that and reverse engineer and figure out which country it's from. So then you know which like plus code it is. So that's the first way. And you can get the last two digits from the like password reset or whatever. It shows like the last two digits on Google, right? Then the other problem was, how do I get the full name? Because if I'm going to brute force this, I need to have a full name to fix on and then brute force it, right? But I didn't know a way to get a full name. So, but after I looked through like a bunch of weird services, okay, so it's for this OSINT thing, right? Google has been like trying to get rid of all this full name leaks for the longest time. So they've been stopping as many leaks as possible. So this was like a big thing that they tried doing in like, I don't remember exactly when, I think it was like April of like 2024. They tried like nuking all the different leaks. But I found for some reason you could like share like a Looker Studio report with somebody and then it like leaks their full name or something if you share ownership.
Doesn't remember his mom's works. Birthday, but remembers the date that they stopped doing the full name leaks on Google's thing.
So the reason this worked is because like if you think about it in Google, right, if you can always see the drive owner's name, right? Like any sort of Google Drive. Mm-hmm. So I think like they have this consensus where if somebody owns a document, you can see the name of that person. But for some reason, they didn't consider the fact that Looker Studio doesn't require the other guy to accept ownership. You can just transfer it and he's not the owner. You don't have to, the guy doesn't have to approve it. For Drive, the guy has to approve it first. So this kind of allowed me to leak the full name of the person. Then I could chain it together. So I can now brute force it. But so I had a whole working PFC. I was like ready to report it. And then like I tried again, it just stops working. Like what? They fixed it. Like I was screwed here. Like I had everything ready and they screwed it. But then I was like saying, okay, is there any way I can like kind of salvage this? Like, is there some like bypass or something I can do? So I was super disappointed. I was looking through like the JavaScript version of it and I saw they passed through like some botguard parameter. So they passed in a real botguard token. So I was like, what if I do this on like the Node.js endpoint? Like if I pass in like a botguard there, like what happens there? So I just tried it like for fun and it seemed to just work. Like it just didn't have any sort of limit. Like you hit one botguard token, you could send infinite requests with that one token.
Wow, that's crazy.
So I could compute it myself, like I could do the proof of work once, then I can use the same token infinite times, and the whole thing worked again. So So for any Google account, if you have a recovery phone number, which is everyone, you can just find the number, right? So that was pretty interesting. And I actually demoed this to a bunch of journalists because they were super interested in this, because there's a lot of impact here for SIM swapping. If you think about it, if you have a guy's phone number, that's probably the hardest part of the SIM swap, right? You can just use a rogue like telco provider or something and then SIM swap a guy and steal their crypto or whatever. So this is the phone number is the hardest part, and this just gives you the phone number. So a bunch of like journalists were interested in it, and they ended up covering it. I think there's a bunch of articles on this. You could get like any US number in like 1 hour. So I did a live demo to them as well. Like they sent me their email. I got the phone number and sent it back to them.
That's great, dude. Oh man, I love it when you get to actually like exploit it and show it. You know, did you report this one to Google as well, or is this one you decided to just go the full disclosure route on, or both?
Oh no, I reported it to Google. Mm. But like while the report was like they haven't fixed it yet, I was able to do a demo to the journalists, right? But I didn't give them the info about the exploit itself. I just like kind of did it on their email because they consented to it, right? Mm. So I had this whole embargo and in the end we released the article and it was pretty cool. But yeah, this was rewarded under abuse. I think it was like $5,000 bounty. Mm.
Yeah, dude. Does that not just feel off to you? Like I feel like the value of a Google, you know, Google account to phone number mapping is like so much more valuable than that for exactly the reasons you said. Like what a powerful exploitation tool for malicious actors.
Exactly. I don't know why they did that. I guess it's because of the abuse problem, but oh well. I mean, the same thing with Google VRP, right? Would be like, it would be like probably like a $30,000 or something like
totally.
That. Right.
Wow, dude. Very good. Yeah, dude, I got to go back and look at that report again from before and be like, because I went back and forth to them like four or five times about it, but they didn't pull it out of abuse. So, all right, man. I think the last one, or maybe we'll do one more section before we cut for this week. But I want to hear you talk about the Discovery Docs and your experiences with that, because I just speaking personally, Google ran a grant back, I think, end of 2024, I want to say, where they gave a bunch of Discovery Docs, you know, to the hackers, and the hackers, you know, were able to use these to attack. And we found out that you can get these actually from hitting, you know, $Discovery Rest. But then since then, there has been a bunch of changes to that after my eyes were opened. And you know, it's not quite as simple anymore. So what kind of tips and tricks do you have for Discovery Docs?
So for this, okay, for Discovery Docs in general, I wasn't actually part of this grant, right? Mm-hmm. So I didn't have access to the Discovery Docs or anything, but I found it through an entirely different approach. Like I was just looking through this OSINT stuff and I was looking at the People API, because this People API was super interesting. You could look up a Gaia user and see a bunch of stuff about it, right? You could look up a Gaia ID. So I was looking at that, but I couldn't figure out all the parameters from just guessing from the request, right? I had to get a doc. So the doc outlined everything, had comments, everything. So this is kind of how I found Discovery Docs. Like back in the day, you could just do, I mean, back in the day, I mean like 2024, you could just do /$discovery/rest, and it would just give you a doc. But recently, I mean, I think within the last year or so, they've nuked all of this. So you can't just, because they had some like scandal or something, like it was related to like Content Warehouse API. So they accidentally released a bunch of protos, and like they also started locking out Discovery documents because of it. And yeah, it was a big thing. But if you're smart, there's still a way around it. Okay, but I won't say here, but if you can figure it out, it's possible. You can still get a discovery document from many APIs.
Interesting. Okay.
Just think about the RPC angle of it.
Okay. I'm going to churn on that. I'm going to churn on that a bit.
So yeah, anyways, I was looking through the discovery document, but the thing is you need the keys to access them, right? You can't just access the discovery document by itself. Like a lot of them require an API key. So I spent this time like going through all the different like various sites. Like, I was doing this manually at first, right? I would just go to all the different sites, capture all the keys I could get, and I had this like database. It was like a humble database of like 200 keys. So, and I was able to sort of like leak a bunch of documents. That's when I published an article as well. Like I wrote the whole like thing about discovery documents. I didn't even utilize it that much. Like I should have, in hindsight, I should have like done more stuff there with hacking it, but I just kind of left it there and I did other stuff. So That's kind of like the whole discovery document thing I did at first. And for YouTube, like the discovery document was interesting because you can't just do /discovery/rest because they did a weird rule where they blocked all like get requests or something. Like you can't do any get requests, but the get requests had to be done for this discovery document to work, right? Because it's /discovery/rest. So how did I get that working? So it turns out you could use some like XHTTP method override. So you can send a post and then convert it to a get, and it just leaks a document. Oh. So it was a super big document. In fact, this is the biggest discovery document that exists in Google. It's the YouTube document. So it had all kinds of APIs inside, and I was able to like trace back and find that YouTube exploit that I had, right, include suspended. I saw it there. And I'm sure there's still tons of exploits you can find on YouTube if you look at this doc. There's like hundreds of methods. It's super big. Mm. There's even this whole like testing CTP inner tube endpoints. Like they're super suspicious. Like maybe you should look at that.
Dude, that there's so, whenever you get one of those docs and you start parsing through it, it's like, I just feel like a kid in a candy shop. I'm like, oh man, I can't wait to like, you know, work through all of the functionality of these things. When you get a primitive like this, when you get a way to get insight into these APIs on any target in a reliable fashion, that is such a high signal that you need to be paying very, very, very close attention there.
Exactly.
Yeah. On Google specifically, it is a little overwhelming though.
Oh, for sure. For sure. 100%. Yeah. So I think the Discovery Docs, they're in this proprietary format, but there's also conversions that you can do to like Swagger and stuff like that. Have you had, is that what you use, or do you parse out the actual raw Discovery Doc itself and put it into a format that's readable for you?
So I wouldn't actually do that. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't actually convert it to Swagger because you're going to lose a lot of stuff.
Exactly.
Because the way these documents are formed, it's like protobuf messages. They're converted to like JSON, right? It's not a standard like Swagger format because, yeah, it's like it's super weird. It's a Google's like own format. If you do this, you're going to lose a lot of comments or like enums or something like that. Like you don't want to lose it. You want to parse it exactly like it is. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that's something to think about.
Do you have like a preferred method of doing that, or do you just have your custom solution?
So I built a whole like front end for doing this. Like I have a front end where I can upload a discovery document, and it shows like a whole thing. I'll explain more about that like later on. But yeah, like that's kind of how I parse it myself. I don't actually. I mean, you can probably make some custom like tool or command line tool or whatever. But front end was the easiest for me because I wanted to build a way I can sort of upload a discovery document, list all the methods, see which one I want, have first party auth already enabled for it, copy it, and immediately start testing it.
Very
nice. So I built out this whole thing.
Very nice, man. Yeah, I definitely want to double click into that. Let's see. We've got one more thing left, but before I think we're going to cut for today. Do you want to talk about Google API hacking at BugSwap Mexico in this one, or should we push that to next week?
Next.
Okay, let's do it. So, all right, that's a wrap, dude. Thanks for coming on this episode. We're gonna tease next week's episode. You know, there's a lot of really, really crazy shit that Brutecat has been doing on Google, and he's gonna show how he uses his AI to hack the APIs that are associated with Google, take advantage of these discovery docs and API key correlations, and put all that together to net over 500K in bounties. So, you know, we try to avoid part one, part two sort of situations on CTBB, but I think this time we're gonna make exceptions. So,
he basically did what me and Justin did, but way better.
Yeah, but like, you know, five times better.
Way better. Yeah,
it's amazing. Sweet. All right. Well, we'll see you guys next week. Peace. And that's a wrap on this episode of Critical Thinking. Thanks so much for watching to the end, y'all. If you want more Critical Thinking content, or if you want to support the show, head over to ctbb.show/discord. You can hop in the community. There's lots of great high-level hacking discussion happening there, on top of masterclasses, hackalongs, exclusive content, and a full-time hunter's guild if you're a full-time hunter. It's a great time, trust me. All right, I'll see you there.